All right, we are reaching the end of our season preview series here on the Dunked On Basketball podcast, but we are not quite done yet. And that means it's time for the Dallas Mavericks with Sports Illustrated's Rob Mahoney. What's up, Rob?
Not a lot, Nate. Thanks for having me.
All right, well, I hope that you do not also have some sort of shadowy knee surgery or torn Achilles tendon that is going to hold you back during this podcast. There wasn't really, you were sort of not clear on whether you could even do the podcast or when you might be able to. There's talk you might have to push it back into December, but I'm glad you're able to join us.
Yeah, I mean, like Chandler Parsons, I don't think the Mavericks have allowed me to talk about that just yet, so we'll just keep it vague.
Yeah, so you obviously have been a Dallas guy for a long time, national writer, but you follow this team closely. The DeAndre Jordan thing, I think, has kind of been done to death. We want to talk about what's going on with them this year. And I think, obviously, the number one story is just that those wing guys don't look like they're going to be healthy to start the season. What's the latest on them?
Yeah, I mean, Wesley Matthews has made it very clear that he wants to be ready for opening night. Whether the Mavs staff agrees with that is kind of a little more up in the air. I don't get that impression that he's going to be out there for the first game of the season. But Chandler Parsons, depending on who you talk to, could be a little further along, but neither of those guys seem like they're going to be ready for the start of the year. And then plus, I mean, really we can argue and we can discuss when they're going to be coming back and what that's going to mean, but ultimately the bigger problem is what they're going to be like when they're on the floor and how gradual that process is going to be and how patient the Mavs are going to be with kind of integrating them full time. And Dallas is a very forward thinking organization in that regard. And they like to pace guys and they like to keep things easy in terms of that kind of physical toll. But at the same time, as you said, this is a team that doesn't have a lot of wing options, that doesn't have a lot of suitable NBA caliber alternatives to those positions. And you're sitting there looking at Chandler Parsons, who's one of the best players on your roster, and Wesley Matthews, the guy who you just paid $70 million to come to your team. They want to get those guys in the mix. They want to get them on the floor and to see kind of that turmoil and that tension play out in terms of wanting to preserve their bodies for the future and make sure that they heal right, and then wanting to kind of present a product on the floor this season that's at least competent and somewhat successful is going to be interesting to watch.
Where are those guys at right now? They haven't played at all in preseason. They've really just – the Mavs have just been sending out what seems like a skeleton crew for preseason, and then you kind of realize, well, the reason that's the case is because not a lot of these guys are healthy, and they're not going to play Dirk a ton in the preseason either. But I saw a report that Matthews took contact in practice for the first time maybe about a week and a half ago. I mean, what are these guys even doing at this point physically?
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is that it's mostly been kind of light contact work, especially for Wes, that he's not doing anything too crazy just yet, which makes you think that. Well, I think there was a quote from Rick Carlisle today that he hasn't been officially ruled out for even these last preseason games, much less the season opener. I just don't get the impression that he's going to be quite there in a way that they're going to be satisfied with. They're definitely doing some contact work, but I don't get the impression that it's anything like NBA speed or NBA physicality just yet.
Yeah, certainly it seems like they're going to have to go through, especially Wes, you would think, but really, I mean, Parsons' injury might have been almost as severe as we find out more about it. Basically, he had that kind of newfangled microfracture where they tried to essentially, I think it was they took cartilage, or I don't know if it was cartilage, but they took bone marrow out of his hip and put it into his knee in the hope that it would regenerate the cartilage or have somewhat of that effect rather than just doing the normal drill holes and kind of create scar tissue that then sort of mimics cartilage. Am I summarizing that correctly?
Yeah, that's about my understanding of it as well.
Yeah, and there is some hope that, it's a pretty newfangled procedure. The results from microfracture haven't really been that great so far, where some of the literature says basically within 12 to 24 months, you're kind of right back where you started. A lot of times with microfracture, just that the kind of scar tissue that it creates by drilling those holes in the affected area ends up wearing off. So maybe this will be a better long-term solution. But, yeah, it's still definitely a concerning surgery. What did you think, by the way, of the fact that he basically sat out the entire, last five, six games of the regular season, tried to come back and play, and just wasn't able to get anything done, and then was ruled out again, and now he has this pretty severe surgery. I mean, either one of two things happened. Either they brought him back for the playoffs on a knee that needed microfracture, or he injured it enough in that attempt to come back that he then required microfracture, neither of which really sounds that good to me.
No, yeah, neither one of those things sounds very good. But, I mean, I hesitate just because, I mean, obviously with this training stuff, it's something that a lot of riders don't want to get into just because we'll have that.
They're usually pretty good, too, this training stuff.
Right, and that's why I think there's a certain benefit of the doubt there in terms of, you know, Casey Smith, the Mavs trainer, is the trainer for USA Basketball. It's a very highly regarded medical and training staff across the board. I don't think that those guys are going to put Parsons in a position where it's going to be exacerbating the damage severely, or it's going to be causing a ton more problems than it otherwise would have. They may have already identified that he was going to need surgery and just decided to keep mum on that, as some teams do. But yeah, I don't want to issue too much judgment in terms of what that might have meant and what that might have been at that time.
Yeah, I'm always skeptical too of the when people will say things like, "Oh, it's injured, but you can't hurt it any worse." That I'm always skeptical of that. I feel like every time that happens and a guy plays on it, he ends up like, maybe not every time, but in a lot of times he ends up kind of not being the same. You know, I think of like Brandon Roy as being an example of that when he came back so early on in like the 2010 playoffs, and that was basically after like 2 weeks after having had an arthroscopic procedure, and it was like, oh, well, he can't hurt it any worse. And then all of a sudden, you know, he was never the same the rest of his career. Maybe that was going to happen anyway. Anyway, that's a bit of a tangent, but something that sort of sticks in my mind is like, how can you not be hurting it any worse when you have a cartilage tear? Like, why wouldn't that get worse? I don't know.
No, I mean, the idea of it sounds ridiculous. That you would be in either a lot of pain or you'd be limited in that kind of way and that it couldn't worsen.
At the very least, you're going to compensate in a potentially damaging way.
Right. And I wonder if, too, I mean, to your point about how in a lot of these cases it doesn't seem to turn out well, I'm sure a lot of it has to do with the location of the injury, too, where there would definitely be guys who need thumb surgery, for example, who can put that off for potentially years if they don't decide to do it at a particular point in time or they don't want to risk their competitive window or whatever it is. But when it's a knee or when it's a lower body thing, I get the impression that it's a little trickier to deal with for sure.
Yeah, I don't mind as much when it's an upper body thing on a basketball player, a shoulder or a thumb or something like that, because that's not the type of thing where, you know, it's impact. You're not doing explosive movements with your shoulder. Like, that's not what makes you who you are as a basketball player. It's your ability to change direction and jump and do stuff like that, where even a small degradation in performance is going to really bother you. Anyway, we're getting on a bit too much of a tangent here, but that tends to happen sometimes. What is your gut feeling for when these guys are back, Matthews and Parsons, and actually playing like starter level 30 minutes a game?
Oof, yeah. I mean, the latter part of it is what's really tricky. I mean, I would expect that by kind of Christmas, turn of the calendar year time, that both of them are at least semi-regular members of the rotation, maybe not quite up to starters minutes, but getting there, that they're kind of getting back into the rhythm, getting back on the court. And especially what that means for Matthews in particular, I don't know as far as how good he's going to be in those minutes.
Right.
But I think that physically they'll probably be cleared up to that level as we get into January, I think.
All right, so what do you think, if that's really true and they're not going to be significant contributors until that point, which I tend to agree with you, by the way, on that, especially for a medical staff that's pretty conservative when you have a large investment in Matthews, especially for 4 years now, what do you think their record is by that point?
It could get really ugly. And a lot of it has to do, you know, Rick Carlisle has done some incredible things with limited rosters over the years, going back to, you know, the post-Brawl Pacers and what he was able to do with that team and just kind of keeping everything together with duct tape and a clipboard. But this is going to be a real test for him just because it's not just the wings. You know, if Darren Williams, you know, he's had this calf issue in training camp in the preseason that's held him out, and he's had a hit.
Yeah, and those are really tricky calves. Like, it's very easy to re-injure. I mean, you think, oh, it's just a calf. But whenever I hear someone has injured a calf, I'm like, all right, well, that's like, you know, it seems to be like 3 weeks. Like Jamal Crawford last year, you know, really struggled with a calf injury a lot down the end of the year, and it seems like that happens to a lot of people.
Absolutely, and Darren, too, has a history of some calf injuries, which doesn't exactly bode well for a quick and sudden recovery and, you know, jumping back into the mix. But even beyond that, you're looking at a team that doesn't have a lot of front court depth, that doesn't have a great backup for Dirk. And yet Dirk is a player who at his age you want to be pacing in terms of his minutes load and his responsibilities. You know, if Parsons and Matthews are delayed by a significant time or they just aren't looking great when they come back onto the court, if the mix isn't right, this team, you know, things could get very ugly. I don't think things are going to go that way necessarily. I don't know. There's something about the combination of Dirk and Rick Carlisle that I trust almost implicitly at this point, just given their track record and given all that they've been able to do together and what, you know, a coach of that caliber and a spacer and a player of Dirk's gravity can give you offensively, I feel like gives you a pretty high baseline, even with a somewhat lacking roster in a lot of other ways. But there's no doubt that there's the floor could give out at this team at almost any moment if Wes and Chandler Parsons aren't ready to go.
They could very easily be 10-20 around Christmas. You know, I think that is, when you consider all the guys that might be sidelined, if D. Will's not going to be ready to start the year, if he's going to be limited, I mean, and Matthews and Parsons both on the sidelines, I mean, who do you think starts for this team opening night? We'll give D. Will the benefit of the doubt and say that he's back. So who are the starters then? Is it Zaza and Dirk in the front court, and then who is it on the wing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the small forward is going to be kind of small forward to be named later. We've seen Jeremy Evans get some of those minutes in the preseason, which is fine.
At small forward,
yeah,
huh?
At small forward, he's been playing a little bit just because, you know, I don't get the impression that Justin Anderson is quite ready for that role yet. And so if they don't go with either Anderson or Evans, you're looking at a lineup that's going to be very small just because they really don't have a lot of small forward options. And even in the backcourt, a lot of the alternatives are things like playing J.J. Barea and Devin Harris together, or if you want to play John Jenkins, who's looked great in the preseason, by the way, at the three, or he could even start at the two if Wes isn't ready to go.
Yeah, Jenkins is kind of undersized for the two, even, if you're going to play him at the three.
Right, right. It's certainly not ideal from a size standpoint and from a defensive standpoint. You know, at least you've got Dirk and Zaza kind of giving you something on that back line, and I think their combination is pretty strong. I like the way they kind of work together. But yeah, the wings and the backcourt, especially if Darren isn't ready to go soon, is not a great situation.
So, yeah, I really, even with all the guys back, if that happens, you know, who is an above average defensive player or even an average defensive player on this roster? You could look at Wes. Pachulia, I think, you know, is a decent kind of clog the middle guy defensively. He'll take some charges. Devin Harris is probably above average at either the one or the two, although he kind of struggles with his injuries. He's not the force that he was at the start of his career defensively. And that's all I see, really.
Yeah, I did the exact same exercise when I was kind of looking over your outline for this podcast, just because they don't have, you know, they've had situations like this in the past, even last season, where it's, okay, we have some gaps on the perimeter, we have some guys who are going to be sieves, who are going to be allowing penetration, but at least we have Tyson Chandler, but at least we have these select pieces, Al-Farouq Aminu, who can step in and pick up a guy who's a kind of a perimeter creator. They really don't have that this year. You know, Zaza's a good defender. He rates well by a lot of defensive metrics. Positionally, I think he does a great job. He's not a great shot blocker. That's never really been a part of his game, but he gets in the way. He disturbs you kind of just enough to cause problems. But I mean, I don't think he's of Tyson's caliber. And on the perimeter, I think that, you know, Wes, when he's healthy, very good defender, and is kind of exactly what this team might need if he's able to get fully back. And as you said, Devin, I think, does a pretty good job by and large. But otherwise, you're looking at a lot of players who are undersized, a lot of guys who are a little bit slow, or in Dirk's case, increasingly slow for their position, or just guys who just don't have a lot of defensive aptitude, like a Charlie Villanueva, for instance. And so it's a lot of offense. It's a lot of cross your fingers and hope this works. It's a tough team for sure.
This team was 20th in defense a year ago, and you know that's even with kind of the Carlisle magic. That's with Tyson Chandler doing everything that he could to paper over a lot of these weaknesses, especially Dirk. I will talk more about him just sort of in a macro sense later, but I think you know he's someone who's getting to be, you know, close at least to me to where he's almost giving up as much defensively as he is offensively. I'm sure you want to do some thoughts on that, but as far as the whole team, they're 20th last year. I see no way that they could possibly be better than that this year, and that they might well be worse, especially when Matthews and Parsons are up.
No, I don't either. And, you know, in a lot of ways, their offense might not be quite as potent, if only because there's so many changes. You know, a lot of it's going to depend on who's healthy and for how long and how good those guys are when they play. But, you know, the engine of this offense over the last couple of years has been Monte Ellis's driving game, and what that opens up in terms of whether it's setting up Dirk, whether it's Tyson Chandler rolls to the rim, whether it's kicking out to shooters, a lot of it was just kind of initiated through that mechanism. And so to take the Mavs out of that, of course, they have other means of creating and of getting stuff going, but it's going to be very different, and there's going to be an adjustment there, and there's going to be a departure from the metrics we saw last season. It's almost not very constructive to say, oh, they were, you know, at one point the best offense in the league. Oh, at one point they, you know, they ended the season, I think, in the top five offensively in terms of efficiency. Just because the roster is so different, and as a result, the whole style of play is going to have to be different from what it was last year.
I think they're really going to miss Tyson Chandler as a role guy as well. They're not really going to have someone who can come down the lane and catch alley-oops. I mean, maybe JaVale McGee, if he ever gets healthy. He's never been known as the most diligent rehab guy in the world, but maybe, you know, with his career mortality kind of in front of him, he might, you know, he's still getting paid $12 million from the Sixers this year, but maybe, you know, that runs out after this year, so he might be a little bit more engaged. You know, you heard, so that it's really, but he hasn't been healthy yet either, so it's really, it's tough to see where, you know, they don't have the dynamic penetrator anymore off the pick and roll. Deron Williams really struggled to finish at the rim, although I think he'll get a little better at that because he was just so bad last year. It might have just been an unlucky year finishing at the basket. And then not having the roll guy as well, yeah, it's going to be tough, I think.
Yeah.
And they're going to miss Brandon Wright, too, who's another guy who is hugely important in that first half of the year before the Rondo trade.
I think so. And that's where the Mavs, I would imagine, are hoping a guy like Jeremy Evans could potentially shine as in a Brandon Wright-like role. Obviously, he's not going to be a Tyson Chandler type, but just as a long, bouncy guy who can finish really well, who could complete some of those plays. Because that's one thing that, you know, Deron Williams is going to be a potentially very good setup artist for this team, a really good pick-and-roll partner both for Dirk or for role guys if they could kind of cobble together some players of that skill set. And maybe Dwight Powell, if he ends up filling a rotation spot or any kind of significant backup minutes, could occupy that as well. But, yeah, obviously Dirk isn't that player. Zaza Pachulia is not any kind of finisher at this stage or really at any point in his career. It's going to be a very different look, and I think the people, whether, you know, basketball fans or basketball, you know, people within the league who don't necessarily fully appreciate what Tyson Chandler does, I think this year is going to be a pretty good case study and a pretty good kind of showing of just how powerful it can be to have a lob target like that rolling down the middle of the lane.
Yeah, and of course DeAndre Jordan would have been awesome for that, and DeAndre Jordan on the Clippers actually had the highest offensive RPM of any center last year, and I think that that's a big reason for that, is because of that gravity that he has either on the baseline in the dunker roll or rolling right down the lane. So let's talk about Dirk a little bit. My theory has been, as I've espoused on this podcast a few times now, is that he's getting to the point where he is not a starting quality big man anymore, because he obviously can't play the five. He lacks any kind of explosion for that to protect the rim, probably not a good enough defensive rebounder. And at the four, when he's out in space, he just gets cooked every single time. I mean, he just doesn't have the mobility. He can't really get into a stance anymore or move laterally. And when you look at that, and then the fact that he wasn't really able to score one-on-one, even in Eurobasket against less athletic defenders, I thought that the Rockets, for as much of that ugly series as I watched last year, were able to switch onto him, and he, for the first time, really wasn't able to punish that guy to the level where you really need him to, and that he just isn't quite hitting his shot quite as well either. You know, I know he's tried to speed up his release, but this might be the year now where you can either switch that Dirk high pick and roll, or, you know, you're not quite as worried about him getting the ball for a 22-footer. What do you think of that opinion? I might be selling too early on him, but I think that this is kind of the beginning of the end for him.
Yeah, I mean, I think your concerns are well founded. All the things you mentioned are real issues. Like those are on film. Those are very evident. In a lot of ways, indisputable. As far as the kind of the broader conclusion, I don't know that I'm ready to go there yet. I just see too much good in what he can offer you, especially. I mean, obviously, at this point, we're talking mostly about offense, because on defense, it's a matter of hiding him. It's a matter of putting him in the right matchups. It's a matter of controlling and mitigating what the damage is going to be there. But offensively,
yeah, I think that he is at the point now where it is very, very difficult to have an above-average defense if he is on your team and playing significant minutes. I think it's deteriorated to that point now.
I think you could definitely, in terms of having a top three, top five offense, like maybe even top eight, I definitely agree with that. I think a lot of it last season, space is definitely an issue, and just in terms of his mobility, as you mentioned. But he's also done no favors by the fact that he was basically, you know, choreographing in the pick and roll with Monte Ellis, who's an abysmal defender, and with Rajon Rondo, who at that point was kind of playing to make a point, whether it was overfouling, just trying to show that he was being aggressive, or slumping back.
Yeah,
and not
that
playing.
Was hilarious. His last minutes in the game, where he just, like, I think he picked up like his third and fourth foul like right away at the beginning of the second half of that game too, and those were his last minutes in a Mavericks uniform. That was just like one of the most comical sequences I've ever seen on a basketball court.
It was ridiculous, especially for a guy that, you know, that was a big part of why Dallas wanted him, was the idea that he could be a stopper between the one and the two, that he could pick up a lot of those guys who are going to be high volume ball handlers. And I mean, that the whole episode is complicated and weird in so many ways, but that image and that minute or so in particular was very strange. But yeah, so the fact that Dirk had those guys to work off of, and you know, even J.J. Barea in stretches, and sure, he had Devin Harris when he was healthy, and that's a decent enough kind of partner to manage pick and rolls with, and Tyson Chandler covering for him. I didn't think that it necessarily put him in the best light. I think he can do a little bit better if given a little bit more support on the perimeter. And I think it's to the point where I think his offense still outweighs it. The defense is bad. The defensive rebounding is limited, as you said. I think he's below about 8 per 36 at this point, which is not a good place to be. But offensively, I think there's still something there. I still think that with the way the defenses respect him, with the way that I think he can still, as you mentioned, he's not quite as potent in terms of exploiting mismatches, in terms of backing guys down, in terms of being the one-on-one threat. He definitely needs to be more of a piece of a more complex puzzle at this point than he was, say, in 2011, where it's just kind of dominating Serge Ibaka one-on-one or whatever it may be. It requires some better planning. It requires some better structure around him, but I'm not quite ready to punt on Dirk as a starter just yet.
I was always one of the people in these last couple of years who really thought that he was still amazing, and I noticed a game that I was at when they played at the Warriors. They took a huge lead, and the Warriors just had no chance of stopping them at all in the first half. The Warriors actually came back and won that game. But during that dominant period, it was all Dirk, right? You just people sticking him in the pick and roll, not leaving him, and you had guys just waltzing down the lane, and Tyson Chandler was going nuts. But so much of his game is about that respect factor, and where you had to just it was like, all right, yeah, this really sucks that we're letting Monte Ellis go right down the lane, but we can't leave Dirk, you know. But now I think it is finally going to change a little bit, his reputation, because you can switch that, or he's just not quite hitting that shot at the level that he was. And so that's where I think it's all going to change, is in sort of those nebulous effects that you don't necessarily see in the box score are going to be a lot less, because of the fact that he's not quite the individual player, and his reputation, the fear factor among defenses, may be a lot less this year. But it sounds like you don't think it's at that point yet.
I don't think it's quite at that point. And then plus, in a lot of cases in the NBA too, there's also a little bit of a delay where if you look at the numbers, and if you, for example, this is kind of the difference between regular season and postseason basketball, where when you have time to really dig in and watch the fact that Dirk isn't knocking down this shot as much as he used to, or he's not exploiting this kind of mismatch as much as he used to, the playoffs are the place where you really take advantage of that. As far as how the Mavs are going to fare in the regular season, given that they may not even make it to the playoffs, I still think that he's going to get some of that respect. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, the fact that teams are not going to be briefed necessarily in that way to give up certain kinds of shots, just because there isn't the level of preparation, but also just those momentary flickers in your brain when you're a pick-and-roll defender or a help defender and you see a wide-open Dirk Nowitzki. There's still that hesitation, I think. There's still that instinct that, oh, I got to get a hand up. Oh, I really need to get out to this. Oh, we really need to bail on this other action or this other rotation to make sure we defend Dirk's shot. I think that's still there to a degree that's going to make them at least pretty competent offensively.
So let's take a look at some of these other guys now who are kind of a little bit more unsung on this team, who they're going to really be relying on Let's talk about John Jenkins first. I mean, he's going to be in the rotation. Probably it looks like he's going to start. He's had a great preseason. What has he been doing that's been so much better than what he was doing in Atlanta, where he was so bad that he got his fourth-year option declined?
It's almost night and day difference, and a lot of that is just kind of the binary of makes and misses and how all that reflects on how you look when you're playing. Because a lot of the shots aren't necessarily different. Dallas's offense obviously is very different from Atlanta's and has been, or from what Atlanta's has been over the last couple of years. John Jenkins, he's been handling the ball more than I expected, and some of that has to do with their point guard situation and exactly, you know, how lacking they've been there with their various injuries and what they've needed in these preseason games. So he's been running a little bit of pick and roll. I've seen comparisons to almost a lot of this is kind of body type and shot selection and the way he plays to Kevin Martin, which kind of makes sense to me in terms of how he's been like performing and producing and what that means. And I think that's kind of a fair stylistic comparison. You're not expecting Kevin Martin type production from him necessarily, but just in terms of a guy who has been better off the pull-up jumper than I would have expected coming in. Who's looked a little cleaner with his dribble in terms of just getting some separation, just getting enough to even get in the lane and get a bump and draw a foul when he needs to. I think there's some skill there, and certainly enough to validate, you know, the kind of minimum investment that the Mavs have made.
Yeah, I thought that was definitely a good kind of second draft chance. But if you think about it, I mean, Atlanta didn't have anybody on the wing who could walk by the end of that Cleveland playoff series, and he still couldn't get on the floor for them, you know? So it was... But his defense, I always thought, was the biggest reason that they just didn't trust him defensively. I would imagine that's probably still not looking that great.
No.
Although I haven't watched that closely for him other than highlights, because just Dallas has had so few guys actually playing that I just sort of like didn't bother to watch any of their preseason games.
Right. No, I mean, there certainly isn't any reason to think that he's going to be vastly improved on that end based on his preseason play. And I mean, I don't try to put too much stock into preseason performance, especially for a team that's missing so many potential rotation players. And, you know, even Dirk missed a couple. It hasn't really been a fully functional Mavs team in a lot of ways. But I would expect that to be a problem as is kind of consistent throughout the Mavs perimeter rotation.
Where's Justin Anderson at? You said that you don't think he's probably ready to start, but if not ready to start and he can't beat out Jeremy Evans, who really has more power forward skills, although he's been taking some threes, I think, you know, he's much better in the pick and roll. And I thought that was a decent investment as sort of a Brandon Wright light. But if he's playing the three over Justin Anderson, it seems like that means Justin Anderson has a long way to go.
Yeah, I mean, some of that I'm sure is just kind of getting a rookie up to speed in terms of exactly what Rick Carlisle and the staff want. Not that you know, John Jenkins or some of the alternatives who have been playing more necessarily even have that experience. I think some of that's just kind of desperation and which guys are rolling. But, you know, Anderson, I like how he is in terms of he's already an NBA body. He has a really good edge to him, I think, as a player that I think will bode well. A good energy, just kind of a competitiveness that suits to, you know, playing well defensively on the wing, to rebounding, which has already been kind of one of his preseason strengths. But, you know, the shot's going to be a work in progress for him, and the Mavs are going to be honing that. They're going to be working on getting him to be at least somewhat reliable in terms of his perimeter shooting and, you know, at least in a spot-up capacity. I just don't know that he's quite there yet in that regard. And when I don't know that he has the tools offensively to really contribute in a meaningful way until he's able to knock down some shots.
Okay, so, he was hitting his shots in summer league, but he does – you know, his performance at Virginia, he only really started becoming a shooter his last year. He doesn't have quite the most classic form in the world, so maybe he's just not quite there yet, which is too bad. I think there was sort of a hope that he could really contribute because he does have that NBA body to defend on the wing, and which, you know, especially with Wes out, they don't really have at the moment. So let's get into the front court rotation. Dirk and Zaza are going to start. Of these other names, so they have Charlie V, they brought back on a minimum contract. Dwight Powell sort of being talked about as maybe a stretch five, stretch four kind of threat. JaVale, maybe when he's healthy. Sam Dallenberg, another guy they brought back. Salah Mejri, if I pronounce his last name correctly, played with Barcelona last year. Played with Real Madrid last year. Of those guys, who do you expect to emerge, as you noted? They don't really have an established backup at any of the front court positions right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think Charlie Villanueva will get some minutes just kind of by separating himself in terms of skill set from that group, just by being another shooter, by being another guy who,
yeah.
And, you know,
At least he was in the system already last year too.
Right. And he's certainly a guy who will give up a lot more than he offers offensively on some occasions, but he has hit shots pretty consistently for the Mavs, and he's done a really good job of kind of filling it up in short bursts. He's not what you want in a backup four, especially for a guy who's backing up a 36, 37 year old, whatever Dirk is at this point. But I think he will end up getting some of those minutes. I think over the course of the year, Jeremy Evans is going to be falling more into the backup four role as the wings come back, as, you know, Chandler Parsons is getting back into a rhythm and is able to sop up a lot of the minutes at the three. I think Dwight Powell will probably end up being the backup center, just because Sam D'Alembert has already kind of had his turn around this carousel, and it didn't exactly go well. I don't really expect anything different this time around. And he's not exactly – I wouldn't say he's a Rick Carlisle favorite from impressions from that first tour. So we'll see how that goes. And as you said, JaVale hasn't been healthy. And then I'm not really the biggest JaVale believer to begin with. But in terms of that, I mean, Powell, he brings something in terms of energy. He brings something in terms of mobility. He's not the best all-around player, not terribly balanced, but I think he can at least fill some minutes and kind of spark things in select runs. And whether or not the jumpers start falling, I mean, they certainly have been experimenting with that, you know, and it was really evident in summer league. I think almost kind of making him a Myers Leonard type or light type player. And so we'll see if that experiment pays off. But the shots haven't been falling yet. That would obviously expand his value if he can knock down some threes or even some long twos consistently.
Yeah. All right. Well, so what? Let's assume now that they finally get West back, they get Parsons back. Well, actually, I'll ask this in two parts. First of all, before those guys come back, what is your crunch time lineup for this team? We'll give them the benefit of the doubt and say that D-Will is back.
Yeah. So I think, you know, without those guys, I think you'll see, you know, Darren obviously running the point. I think you'd probably see Devin Harris at the two, unless John Jenkins really emerges in a big way in the early season. So he would be a possibility there. The three is where things just get really tough.
Yeah, I mean, you talked about Jenkins playing at the three, and I kind of chuckled at that given his lack of size. I mean, maybe Deron Williams even would be the guy who guarded threes on the other team in that situation, and you put Jenkins on just whoever the least threatening guy is. But when your alternatives are Evans, and if you don't think Anderson is ready, maybe it is John Jenkins playing at the three.
Yeah.
Maybe that really is their best option, which is somewhat terrifying from a defensive standpoint.
It really is. But given Rick Carlisle's track record, too, I also wouldn't entirely throw out the possibility of him running in desperate situations some kind of three-point guard-type lineups, whether it's J.J.
Yeah.
Barea or Raymond Felton coming into that third spot alongside Darren and Devin Harris. That's something that the Mavs have toyed with and have done over the years, especially these last few. So I wouldn't throw out that possibility. But, yeah, without Wes and Parsons, there really aren't a lot of great options to close games. And when you take Darren out of the mix, you know, if his calf thing persists, it could get messy.
All right, so what about when everyone's back then? I guess it's just as probably the starters, D-Will, Matthews, Parsons, Dirk, and then Zaza would be the best lineup for closing games.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, the kind of unfortunate thing about the Mavericks is that if all those guys are healthy, that's a good group. I think that's a pretty balanced group. It's not one that's going to be contending for a title necessarily, but it's one that I think it would certainly be kind of in that playoff caliber. All those players complement each other in very interesting ways where, you know, Darren is going to be able to create and to run pick and roll with guys like Dirk who at this point in his career needs a guy who can do that. And I think Darren can be better than he showed last season. And I really like the kind of interplay between Chandler Parsons and Wesley Matthews, with Wes being a really good spot-up option, a guy who can go down into the post to bully, you know, other guards, who, especially smaller guys who are on him, whereas Parsons, last season, really in a smaller role or in select games in an outsized role, was really efficient as a pick-and-roll scorer, and I think is probably underrated as a playmaker in those situations as well. And so part of this, you know, part of the whole scheme all along, and I think the Rondo thing kind of derailed it a little bit, was to get Parsons more of those kinds of creative opportunities. And so if he can get back and get healthy, this could be a good opportunity to him to not only showcase what he can do, but salvage a lot of what could potentially go awry in the Mavs offense in a lot of ways. I, you know, and Zaza not only as a defender and a rebounder, but as a really good high post passer and a guy who can contribute even without being a scorer. And so, it's not perfect. It's not airtight, but the Mavs starting five, as they were able to kind of cobble it together after the DeAndre Jordan mess, I think is altogether pretty solid if those guys can get healthy.
Yeah, I think of them as kind of a 500 team, maybe a little bit below, especially with everyone healthy, although when you consider that these guys are coming off major injuries, Parsons and Matthews, and may not be the same players that they were beforehand, I'm kind of pricing that in. It may be a little bit below 500, but it's just, if they really aren't back until Christmas, I mean, it's hard for me to see how this team gets to 500 over the course of the year, really. And that's kind of how, now that I'm really starting to think about this, that's kind of what I'm thinking is like, all right, they're 10 games under 500 at Christmas, and then they play 500 ball the rest of the way if they try really hard the rest of the way, because they also have that top seven protected pick that they owe to Boston.
Yeah. I mean, I think they could be better than a 500 team when everybody's back. And I mean, keep in mind the Christmas thing, too. I mean, that's just pure guesswork by me.
Sure. They could be back early.
Right. And that kind of needs to be priced into our projections of what their record could ultimately be. And I think there's also a possibility that even if they both aren't back, that they aren't quite as bad as 10 games under 500. I know that the West is brutal. I know that it will, you know, the schedule will be unforgiving in spots. But I think they could surprise in some ways, especially I think Darren is probably the mystery ingredient in this, in terms of if he can at least get back into the lineup sooner than the other two, as you would probably expect given the severity of his injury relative to theirs, I think that helps them in a really big way, just in terms of having another guy who can fill out that backcourt. It allows them to have a little bit more flexibility in terms of building the rotation with him and Harris being able to play together. We'll see how it pans out. I think that I'm probably a little more optimistic about the Mavs, even given all that I've been saying about their limitations and their problems and their injuries over the course of this podcast. But they definitely have a lot to figure out.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like you're agreeing with everything that I'm saying is wrong, and then you're like, it's still going to be okay, though. and maybe that's born of the fact that Carlisle has been able to get a lot out of some pretty limited rosters in the past as well, but I think the difference for me now is just that Dirk isn't going to be as good, still is going to play even less minutes than he was, and they don't really have the horses offensively. I always believed in this team's offense pretty well, except for that one like post-lockout year when they were actually pretty bad, but aside from that, I've always believed in the team's offense, and this year I can't quite think that, and I also just don't see a scenario where they're out of the bottom 10 in defense, and I think I'm thinking of them as more really kind of an average offensive team now, and that obviously adds up to below 500.
Yeah, no, it's a fair equation.
What do you see as the big strengths and weaknesses for this team?
Well, I mean, just like we were talking about in terms of strengths, I think preparation is probably at the top of that list, just in terms of Carlisle being one of the best coaches in the business. If you talk to any of his current or former players, I mean, the level of preparation and the specificity of their play calling from game to game as it tailors to opponents is a theme that comes up a lot. And so I think there's a lot to be said for just how well the Mavs scout, how well they prepare, and what Carlisle will bring to the table in that regard. As far as the personnel, I think when healthy, shooting is definitely a strength of this roster, because between Nowitzki, Darren Williams, Wes Matthews, you know, Jenkins, if he's in the rotation, Parsons, who I think is an improving shooter and at worst kind of bottoms out at being maybe average or slightly above average. If Charlie Villanueva is going to be in the rotation, even guys like Devin Harris and J.J. Barea, who aren't great shooters by the numbers necessarily, but can step in to hit shots and are at least...
Yeah, those are guys you're not going to just say, hey, we can leave this dude wide open.
Right, and I think that's such an important distinction in the way that teams defend in the NBA currently. And so I think altogether there'll be a lot of spacing, and what the Mavs can do with that is another matter entirely. But when everybody's back, there's a lot of options and a lot of room to stretch the floor. I think the basketball IQ should be pretty good ultimately. And a lot of that, you know, even just going from Monte to Wes Matthews is a pretty big jump. Monte has a lot of strengths, but he doesn't necessarily see the floor that well. He's not the most discerning player in terms of his shot selection. Matthews is kind of the image of discretion in a lot of ways, and a good counterpoint to that. And I think, you know, if they can get everybody back, there are a lot of guys who move the ball, guys who are smart decision makers, guys who I think in terms of the way they play are generally unselfish, who can pass out of double teams, who can who can find open teammates, and that should bode well for them. And then ball control, just because, you know, Rick Carlisle's coached some really low turnover teams, even with point guards who aren't.
That's a great point. We always forget about turnovers in these evaluations, and I'm glad you brought that up.
No, absolutely. And I mean, even something with, you know, when Jameer Nelson was the Mavs starting point guard, turnovers were not a problem. You don't necessarily.
Yeah. And Dirk is one of the greatest offensive players in history when it comes to turnovers, with his high usage and basically still never turning it over.
Absolutely. And so, you know, with the way they play is going to be different, and maybe there's some room there in terms of maybe turning the ball over a little more, maybe with all the new faces and the new people in the mix that things could get a little sloppy. But ultimately, I think that'll be a strength of theirs. As for the weaknesses, health, as we've mentioned time and time again, is a big problem. Getting guys healthy, keeping them healthy, making sure that they're ready to contribute in a meaningful way to the rotation. The depth, especially in the front court, is an issue. I mean, when you're trusting guys like Charlie Villanueva or Samuel Dalembert to play regular roles, that's a problem. And maybe one of the kind of unknowns, whether it's Salah Mejri or whoever it is that ends up making the roster, maybe they could step into something and help alleviate some of that. But as it stands now, the depth, both on the wing and on the front court, appears to be a bit of an issue. Defense, given that, as we mentioned, you know, Zaza Pachulia, Wes Matthews, and Devin Harris are really the only adequate or above average defenders on the roster. And then rebounding, you know, this was an awful rebounding team last season.
Oh, yeah.
And they, you know, I think they ranked, you know, near the bottom on both sides of the ball rebounding-wise, and they've downgraded significantly in going from, you know, Tyson Chandler, who's one of the best defensive rebounders in basketball, to Zaza, who that is not necessarily a strength of his, given the fact that he's not much of a leaper. He has, you know, he's physical and has a big body. He gets enough rebounds to get by, but he's not exactly a bulk rebounder. And they also gave up Al-Farouq Aminu, who's a real, you know, one of the best rebounders at the small forward position. And, you know, Parsons is fine, but when he's out and when you're relying on these other guys, you're really going to need players like Anderson to be physical, to be contributing on the boards. Even guys like Deron Williams, basically anyone who has any kind of size advantage, is going to be very much needed on the glass for Dallas.
Yeah, it's interesting you talked about shooting, and you don't think of that many teams that have a lot of shooting that turn out to be a bad offensive team. Now, I think the way I would approach it when they're fully healthy as an opposing coach is just a ton of switching. I think that would be, because I don't think this team really has the guys who can create shots one-on-one very well, with what I see as Dirk's decline, and maybe Wes Matthews can get into the post on some guys who are undersized, but, you know, I don't see D-Will as someone who can blow by someone in a one-on-one situation anymore. Parsons, especially coming off an injury, I see him as more of a pick-and-roll type of guy, and so, yeah, I think switching could be a very, very effective strategy against this team, and that's how you mitigate the shooting, and those guys maybe, you know, never get open, and now you're taking a contested jumper because they can't get all the way to the rim against these switches or post up really that well.
For sure. And, you know, the teams that are practiced in that and that employ that strategy regularly would definitely have a lot of success against the Mavs. The issue is more for the teams that are kind of employing it on the fly, or who that's not a regular part of their packaging defensively. I always get a little wary about teams that just kind of jump into switching because it seems like it might be situationally appropriate, just because it does require a lot of familiarity with knowing exactly when you're going to be switching, what situations it's going to be called for. It can get really, really messy if teams aren't, you know, disciplined and familiar with it. So, yeah, of course, teams like the Warriors, for example, any team that's aspiring to play defensively like Golden State did, is going to have a big weapon, just because Dallas doesn't have, as you said, a lot of explosive athletes, a lot of guys who have a quick first step. There's a lot of it's going to be dependent on ball movement, and it's going to be, you know, if we can get the swing pass to this guy with enough of an advantage, maybe he can exploit the defender with a pump fake, with a pass fake, with a jab step, and then go the other direction. A lot of it's going to be situational. It's going to require a little doing and a little more chemistry and a little more ball movement that I'm sure the Mavs would even like. You'd like to have kind of that one-on-one option, whether it's on the perimeter and inside, and given that Dirk really isn't that guy on a reliable, high-usage basis anymore, there's going to be nights where they struggle, for sure, with teams who defend that way.
Yeah, I could see them beating up pretty badly on some of the bad defensive teams once they get all their guys healthy and with the preparation advantage, as you said. But I think against real good teams, especially real good defenses, they could be in some big trouble. So give me your predicted record for the Mavs this year. You know, I normally say, you know, assuming that there's decent health, but with so many injuries that have already happened, I think you have to kind of price that in.
Yeah. This is one that I've wrestled with a lot, just in terms of, you know, as you said, the injuries, it's hard to know exactly what they're going to get from what guys when. I have a hard time thinking that they're going to be, if they're going to be a below 500 team, which I think that they probably will be, that they're going to be too far below it. So I think I fall somewhere in the maybe 40 and 42 range for the season, and maybe that's optimistic. Maybe that's giving this team way too much credit. There's just something about it where I'm not quite ready to pencil them in below that just yet.
You know, this one is a tough one for me, because if I just said, hey, here are the injuries, this is what I expect this team's quality to be, I'm thinking kind of 36 and 46, 37 and 45, 35 and 47, that kind of range. But they also have this incentive of the draft pick, and I don't know how much that's going to play in. We've had Cuban talk about, yeah, you know, we were going to tank if we didn't get DeAndre, and now he, of course, is backed off of that predictably. I mean, I the fact that he said that doesn't necessarily mean that he doesn't really think that tanking is the best idea. But on the other hand, you're in a situation where Dirk is taken way less than his market value to be here into the twilight of his career. He doesn't want to be on some tanking team. Maybe you can kind of sell him on it that we keep our pick and then, you know, we're going to reload again, you know, next year. This has kind of been like the wait till next year free agency team for quite a while now. And they'll have plenty of space again this upcoming summer, though they'll have Parsons as a free agent, and Dirk, I think, has a player option for the next year. So I don't know. There's part of me that says, hey, especially if they start off poorly, which I think that they will, that then it's going to be, hey, Wes, Chandler, take your time, guys. Dirk, we're going to preserve you. Let these young guys kind of play, even though there aren't really any young guys other than Anderson on the roster you would see as a big part of the future. And that, you know, they end up kind of miraculously keeping that top seven protected pick. But, I mean, to do that, they'll probably have to get under 30 wins, and I don't know if there's that little talent on this team. And Rick Carlisle seems like someone he's not going to stop competing on a night-to-night basis either. So I definitely think that there is more downside than upside on this team, but I'll just stick with kind of what my gut feeling is. I'll go 37 and 45 for this team.
Yeah, and what you're hinting at, too, in terms of kind of being torn between those extremes of obviously they have incentive to try to retain their draft pick, but at the same time they have a roster that doesn't have a lot of upside. I mean, this is kind of what Dallas entered the summer with, and I think, you know, if they had landed DeAndre, it would have really improved their situation dramatically in so many ways, the most important of which is you have something to go to free agents with. You have something to build around. You have a bit of a young core that, while they're not guys who are 19 and 20 and just poised to explode, between Wes and Chandler Parsons and DeAndre Jordan, that's something tangible that I think you can really build a solid team around. But as it stands, when those plans fall through and you're left with trying to do the best for Dirk, which is, you know, a priority on some level for this franchise, given his service there and how long he's been there.
They absolutely, as soon as they didn't get DeAndre, they absolutely should have tanked the season, I think.
Yeah.
You know, like for the long term, I mean, this is a team that has probably some of the least assets of any team in basketball going forward right now.
Yeah, and I wonder, too, how much that factored into Chandler Parsons' contract situation as well, given that he has a player option for 2016-17. Wanting to show him something or wanting to give him, hey, these are the pieces that we might have on the roster, whether it's Wes or DeAndre or whoever.
Well, let me stop you on that. This is one that I was thinking about. What do you think, what is the percent chance that he opts out next summer? He's coming off this injury. He may not have as good of a year as he's had these last couple of years. Granted, there is always a shortage of wings, and there's going to be all this space around the league. I still don't know that I think of him as much more than an average starter. And I think my rule of thumb has been you're getting about $15 million a year if you're an average starter, but he could also lock in for a longer period of time potentially as well. What do you think the percent chance is that he opts out next summer?
I still think it's pretty high. I think he'll want to play the market if he's been in anything close to his previous form. You know, as you mentioned, obviously the situation changes and the number shifts if he's not really playing well or if he comes back into the season very late or anything like that. But I think especially Wes's situation, seeing that firsthand, and just how much a team is willing to invest under this year's cap. Under next year's cap, where there's even more money to go around, there's going to be a lot of teams that are kind of trying to position themselves for, you know, a very select group of wing players who are really of that caliber or better. And you know, only so many only one team's going to get Kevin Durant, and beyond that, it's just not a lot out there in terms of really adding to your team in a meaningful way on the wing. And while Chandler Parsons is going to come with question marks, especially with that injury, I think that there's going to be a handsome deal for him if he decides to opt out, assuming everything doesn't go completely off the rails in terms of his rehab and recovery.
Yeah, there is a chance that he may just never be the same guy, or that it may take him a while to get back. And he'll be 27 next offseason as well. I still agree with you. I think there's probably a 75% chance that he opts out, especially when you also consider that there's some labor uncertainty coming up in 2017 as well. So he may want to lock in for a longer term contract at that point. You know, we'll see kind of what the labor climate looks like by this offseason and whether it seems like it's acrimonious or not. All right, let me give you another percent chance question. What percent chance is there that they finish in the bottom seven and keep that pick?
Oof. I don't tend to think it's very likely. So I'm going to go with not only because of the injuries, but as you said, even if there are problems with Wes and Chandler Parsons getting back and getting healthy, I just think that there are going to be some teams who really go for it, you know, who are going to have some pretty serious midseason injuries and just bail on the idea of competing for the playoffs. Somebody's going to be significantly worse than expected. It always kind of works out that way. And those teams are going to really lean in that direction. I just don't know that the Mavs are going to be one of them. For some reason, I don't necessarily, you know, Cuban certainly talks about tanking a lot. And he's asked about it a lot in terms of whether the Mavs would do it and in what situations and when it makes sense. And maybe he'll deem that this year is one of those years, given that the Sixers from the outset are really the only team that looks like it's going to be overtly and just terrible. And even then, they may be improving by a couple of wins relative to last year. So maybe if there is a time to tank, it's now. I don't get the impression that Dallas is going to go that way, unless things go just completely disastrously. So I'm going to say that there's maybe a 25% chance, maybe a 20% chance of that pick being in the top seven.
Yeah, that's about the number that I would say as well. I might even push it down to 15. And this is another reason why this trade was so ridiculous, to make it top seven protected. I mean, if it were top 10 protected, I think that's a number where you can push for the playoffs, and then, all right, if we're clearly not going to get there, we can change gears and we can get into the top 10. Miami and Charlotte both did that last year, basically. They were both kind of in contention, and granted that was in the East, but they're in contention the last couple of weeks, and then they just lost all the rest of their games once it became clear they weren't going to make it and got into the top 10. Top seven, it would take epic tank job by this team, and it might be like pretty hilarious to see what they try if they really make that decision, you know, to see like how little they're going to be playing some of their guys, or who's going to be getting minutes. I mean, it would be a pretty obvious job, and this is why I think that draft picks should either be lottery protected or nothing, because you just lead to these completely ridiculous situations. I don't mind kind of season-long rebuilding, that sort of tanking, you know, Sixers style tanking. That doesn't bother me, but hey, we got to keep our protected pick to get to this specific number, hell or high water. That's what kind of kills me. And this could lead to a pretty comical attempt, but it may be that they're just, you know, too good for that and it wouldn't be possible anyway. But then, you know, I mean, I think the likely scenario is they're giving up the 10th, 11th pick in the draft is where they're going to end up.
Yeah, and I wonder if maybe the Mavs, you know, given that the protections are static, I think it's top seven protected for the next 4 years, that this may have been a pick that they wanted to convey a little more quickly. This wasn't one that they were really protecting against all that much, that it was, okay, we give ourselves some buffer in case things really go to hell, but otherwise this is one that we feel comfortable conveying in 2016 and moving on from that debt, especially because, you know, it having that on the books influences the way you can operate in potential trade scenarios. And as you said, this team doesn't have assets. All they have are those future picks in terms of things that other teams are really going to want. And even then, those may not be that great. I don't know. Or, you know, it kind of remains to be seen given given how the team performs this year. But I wouldn't be surprised if they had kind of planned it to convey this season and protected it accordingly.
Yeah, the other thing when we talk about future assets is this team has a lot of guys with player options for next year too, whether it's Parsons, whether it's D. Will as well. You know, if he has a good year, he's only making $5 million. He'll probably opt out. He agreed to a buyout with the Nets, so there's no set off with the Nets. He has all the incentive in the world to get as much money as he can. And even Dirk could opt out as well. That's going to be another kind of interesting one to watch, and it'll be hard to project what effect a good or bad season might have on all of those situations. So what do you see as the absolute best case scenario for this team?
I think the best case is that Parsons and Matthews both come back and play in a way that is both helpful for the case this season for trying to make a long shot, or maybe it's not even a long shot, trying to make a run at the playoffs, in a way that's also sustainable and that's healthy for them long term, especially Matthews, given the fact that the Mavs have invested a 4-year deal with him. And, you know, they want to bring Parsons back. They're going to want to have him healthy, and so you obviously don't want to risk too much there. And so if they're able to balance that and give themselves a good shot at making the postseason, which I think is, you know, maybe a reach, but within range of their ability, and given some of the injuries to teams like New Orleans, given, you know, we'll see how Phoenix performs and whether Utah can really play up to its capabilities. But I think there's at least some opening there. And so if they can play up to that level in a way that's healthy for their roster, and they can at least give Dirk something to work with in one of the twilight seasons of his career, I think that's a pretty good case.
Yeah, I see them, their ceiling is kind of 43, 44, maybe 45 if those guys can come back. I still think even if they do, there's no way they can play that many minutes coming off these injuries. I think the depth is really a problem. But even if they're 500, it's possible that this is one of those years where that gets you in the conversation for the eighth seed in the West. You know, I don't think that you're looking at Utah or you're looking at Phoenix or you're looking at Sacramento as absolute dead bang 45 or higher win teams for the eighth seed. And then even New Orleans, with all of their health problems now, they could be down kind of in that lower 40 win range as well. So it's not out of the realm of possibility for me, but I just think that those guys are not going to be on the court enough and that they're going to be at such a disadvantage from a slow start. And also, you know, Dirk is being 37, he could not only is he not going to play that many minutes, but he could easily miss time as well. You have to imagine, or will miss games for rest. I mean, you would have to think that, you know, him playing more than maybe 70 games might be looked at as a pretty good outcome as well.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, so last question I have for you here. How would you rate this team's ownership / front office / management? I mean, I guess we could probably, we'll go maybe since like 2010 or so. I mean, it's been the same regime for a long time now.
Yeah, I mean, that's what kind of separates the Mavs from a lot of teams, you know, maybe excepting the Spurs, in that they really had a pretty stable combination of ownership and management. I think Donnie Nelson took over in 2005 as general manager, I think. And so you're looking at a pretty long timeline in terms of his total body of work. So, yeah, if you go back a little further beyond the five-year window you described, things are pretty good, and better than that. I mean, only what six?
Yeah,
six,
they won a championship with some great moves.
Right.
I mean, but yeah, so maybe that's the fairer inquiry is, since winning the championship, what would your grade be? I mean, that's sort of like a pretty good line to delineate, because I mean, they did win that championship, and it's pretty much impossible to give them a bad grade for a team that's won a championship in the last 5 years and did it really with only one star as well at the time. But since then, maybe is a better question.
Since then, I would give them, I'll say a C plus, maybe a C. I don't think, you know, in terms of the broader vision of the team, I think most of their moves have been pretty defensible, have been pretty understandable. You don't necessarily agree with all the specifics. You may not have thought they needed to trade for Rondo, or that they really should have risked alienating Tyson Chandler to go after DeAndre Jordan. But I think that the larger goal of really centering your team around going after those superstar caliber players is the right way to go for a team in Dallas's position that doesn't have prospects with upside, that doesn't have a lot of guys who are really going to be improving dramatically over the course of a couple of years. And given a lot of that is their own doing. This is a team that has moved down and out of the draft almost systematically every season. And the players that they have picked over the last, you know, half dozen years or so, you're looking at, you know, Jared Cunningham's and Shane Larkin's. I can't remember when Dominique Jones was drafted, if he's in that window. Guys who either have flamed out of the league or have left the Mavericks quickly, who they've passed on. There have been some success stories for sure. A guy like Jay Crowder jumps out in terms of the Mavs drafting well and really making the most of a pick. There have been some great value signings, guys like Vince Carter, Brandon Wright, Al-Farouq Aminu, obviously bringing Dirk back on better and better deals over time. Even some of what they did this summer in terms of, you know, getting Deron Williams' buyout and getting him at a really team-friendly price on, you know, a one-year deal with a one-year player option, or picking up Zaza Pachulia via trade essentially for nothing. Those aren't teams that make Dallas, or those aren't trades that make Dallas a great team, but they're trades that at least put them into the conversation of being something a little bit more interesting, a little bit more competent. They're really tough because, you know, as we mentioned, you can't discredit the fact that this was a team that, you know, only six franchises, I think, have won a title since Donnie Nelson took over, and to be one of those six is an exemplary category. The Mavs have been in the playoffs like 9 of the 10 times, I think. They've won 50 games, I believe 7 of the 10 times since he took over, and been to the finals twice. That's a hell of a track record. And so that they've dipped since winning the title, I think, goes without saying. This team would not be where it is if there hadn't been some mistakes made. But a lot of those have been really strange situations that I don't know if they're completely fair to say, oh, that was such an obvious error. Things like the Lamar Odom episode, even little things like the weird kind of Derek Fisher saga where he was the team starting point guard and left kind of very unceremoniously. There have been a lot of strange things that have kind of come through town since the Mavs won the title. Some of them have been the management's doing and some of them have not. They certainly have their faults, but ultimately I don't think that they've done a terrible job, and I generally agree with their goals, if not always the execution of them.
Yeah, I think so, right? A lot of this looks very different if they just were able to get in contention for and sign the free agents that they thought that they could get. And maybe in some ways just the fact that they won that 2011 championship and the fact that they had Dirk almost gave them too big a heads on thinking that they could get these free agents, whether it's D. Will in 2012, which, you know, who knows how he would have turned out if he were in Dallas. He probably would have been better than with the Nets, and they could have helped keep him a little bit healthier as well. Whether it was Dwight the following year, DeAndre Jordan this year, they obviously got very close to, and we'd be thinking about them differently if they had just gotten him. And I think the idea of getting Dirk on those small contracts is pretty good. Monte Ellis was a pretty good signing, although that was somewhat ridiculed at the time. Jose Calderon was probably a pretty terrible signing, but then getting Tyson Chandler for him last year was a really good move as well. You know, I think when you look at all that stuff, you're probably in the B-minus, B range if you're really looking at the process, at what the thinking was at the time. But then the Rondo trade, I really have to downgrade them for that a lot. And I understood what the thinking was, which was, all right, we need a little bit more juice defensively. I don't know why they felt like a point guard who didn't really have any evidence that he was a good defensive player since tearing the ACL was the answer. I don't know why they felt like he was going to be a good offensive player for them. I mean, it was just, let's take a gamble on the fact that this guy, you know, who hasn't been good in 2 years since tearing the ACL and frankly was quite overrated by any advanced metrics or just looking at Boston's offensive output at any time since he, since basically 2010, to think that he was going to not have a really negative effect on the offense was bad. But all right, maybe you say, hey, we weren't winning a championship. This was a high upside move. You still vastly overpaid for that, right? Like, think of how good, like, Brandon Wright and Jay Crowder were two of, like, really good signings this offseason. How good would they look if they just had Jay Crowder right now, you know, and were able to re-sign him to $7 million a year for the next 5 years? Or if they still had Brandon Wright to just run some pick and roll with Dirk, and at least you could look at them as, all right, now this is going to be a really good offensive team. They could have kept those guys, just continued on the same path that they were, and been in totally good position for this offseason, brought in some free agents. And I think if they had those two guys on the team, you could look at this as still being, you know, maybe a sixth seed, seventh seed, fifth seed, you know, even with Parsons being out, and they still could have signed Matthews. So, I mean, that was just such a bad trade. The top seven protected pick, not getting more protection on it, and the fact that they gave up two really pretty quality rotation guys, even maybe a starter on the wing in Crowder for half a season of Rondo, even if he was going to work out, they were going to have to overpay him to make him stay. It was just such a grave miscalculation to me that they were willing to give up so much for him. And it's pretty remarkable that people were saying Danny Ainge didn't get enough for him when you see what ended up happening.
Yeah, and I think that the way it unfolded was pretty much close to a worst-case scenario in terms of what could possibly have happened after trading for Rondo. Pretty much every player combination in the Mavericks mix became worse once Rondo got there by net rating. I think maybe the only exceptions are ones where he wasn't on the floor, things like Devin Harris and Tyson Chandler. And you know,
What did you think of that move at the time?
I mean, just because we've kind of been discussing, I think I saw it as you described, as a team that didn't think that it was going to be good enough to win a title, that has pressure within its own group to be competitive, to keep pushing, to be a contending or near contending team, and thought that they could manage whatever Rondo brought. And I think that they, you know, I don't think that they necessarily bought into the idea that he was going to be exactly what he was before the ACL, you know, back when Rondo was a little bit more of a household name and a more established player and more consistent. I mean, he's fallen off in so many ways. I don't think they were expecting him to be at the top of his game, but I think that the idea was that between the players they had, between Carlisle's talents as a coach, that they could manage a lot of what Rondo doesn't do well and what he takes away from you. That was obviously not the case. The offense pretty much cratered upon his arrival and never recovered. The defense, I think, improved, but not significantly enough to really help them. And so they ended up worse off than they were before, where before they, you know, they were, I believe they had the number one offense in the NBA when Jameer Nelson was their starting point guard.
They had one of the best offenses of all time through, like, 2 months of the season last year.
And, I mean, it was a machine for not only wide-open jumpers, for great passing and pick-and-roll play, but kind of uncharacteristic lobs. It was a beautiful thing for a while. I just get the feeling that they looked at the roster and they looked at the performance and thought they didn't have enough guys who could prevent dribble penetration to really be any kind of factor in the Western Conference playoffs. And so they leaned into that. They rolled the dice. They, as you said, in retrospect, it definitely looks like they gave up too much. At the time, I think I was forgiving of kind of their desperation, I guess, in that sense. But, I mean, I've not been a Rondo fan basically since 2008. I don't think he, you know, if you go back and even look at his track record in Boston, there's just not a lot of proof of the fact that he meaningfully, if at all, improves your offense. It's a lot of kind of very counterproductive things, and then defensively he just hasn't been the same at all since that surgery, as you mentioned. So it's hard. It's a hard situation. It was a hard call for them, surely. And it's one that I think has to be counted against them if you're looking to kind of give them this kind of letter grade. But it's one that I think is explainable, at least in their desperation.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest things, too, is just misevaluating Wright, who admittedly could be a free agent, but they would have had his bird rights. Or at least early bird rights. I can't remember exactly how long he was on the team before that. But and then Crowder as well, who is a starting small forward. I mean, that's two guys they gave up who were better than the guy that they got, and they gave up a protected first-round pick as well. I mean, that's just a really, really severe miscalculation, and I never saw where this perceived amazing upside was with Rondo, even if you were getting 2012 Rondo, and then considering also what you would have had to pay him the upcoming summer as well. I mean, I'm sure they kind of had things worked out in like a wink-wink deal before they traded for him, which obviously, you know, neither side wanted to stick with ultimately because things went so poorly. But still, I mean, you know, they probably, if things had gone well, they're paying him $12-13 million a year or something going forward, which for a guy who's 29 would have been pretty ugly too. So I don't know. I mean, it was a trade that I didn't agree with at the time, and, you know, has only gotten to look worse in hindsight.
Yeah, it's certainly not a trade I would have made. But at the same time, I mean, what's so complicated about the Mavs front office and their track record is the guys you mentioned, like Jay Crowder and Brandon Wright, these are guys who the Mavs put themselves in a position to retain because they found them at such incredible values. And so it's like the Mavs are the front office that selects Jay Crowder in the second round is the same one that ends up giving him away, and that signs Brandon Wright for the minimum is the one that gives him away. The front office that gets Tyson Chandler for Eric Dampier's expiring contract is the same one that lets him walk, and then gets him back for Jose Calderon's bloated contract and lets him walk. And so there's a lot of counterproductivity in terms of doing things right and then letting go of those players, or doing things right and not developing those players in the right way, or whatever it may be. But ultimately, I mean, there are a lot of hits on Donnie Nelson and Mark Cuban's resume, so to speak, over these last even 5 years, even since the title. It's just hard to see in the context of this current roster, given the way that some of those things ultimately played out.
Yeah, I would probably go see ultimately for those reasons that you mentioned. And really, there's a lot of kind of cross purposes. And were it not for the Rondo trade, I'd be feeling a little bit differently about it. But yeah, just being unlikely to even retain your draft pick, it's just that trade could haunt them for a very long time, you know, especially because they could have had kind of two young, maybe lower end starters, but still starters under contract relatively cheaply for what those guys have ended up eventually signing for, had they kept them. So it's really, you know, it's tough going forward for the Mavs now. It's hard to see what the path is for relevance unless they can just somehow. I mean, they're not in the Kevin Durant sweepstakes. They're not in the Mike Conley sweepstakes. They're not in the Al Horford sweepstakes. I don't see any of those happening this summer. So if that's the case, and they could even lose Parsons as well, they have all this cap space. Who are they going to spend it on? There's nobody who's going to change the game for them this coming summer either. And then, you know, Dirk's probably going to retire, and you're just going to have to be in the lottery for 3-4 years to really get back to being something good, unless they have some unexpected trade or free agent coup that we just don't see coming somehow.
Right. I mean, it's going to be rough. And this is a team and a franchise that has not had losing seasons in a long time in terms of any kind of sustained losing. There have been a couple, you know, blips here and there. But yeah, it's going to take some creativity. It's going to take some doing, especially as you mentioned, if Parsons leaves. And even if he stays, there's a lot to work out. There's a lot to build before this team is really ready to contend for a title again.
Yeah, and maybe if Parsons and Matthews can get back to being real good players, they could eventually be moved if they really go into the full teardown once Dirk has moved on. And, you know, despite the fact that Dirk signed for such a low amount, in some respects, he's kind of holding the franchise hostage right now in a similar respect to Kobe Bryant, maybe not with his salary, but just with the fact that they can't break it down and start rebuilding. And the fact that they're just going to kind of be mediocre for these last 2 years, probably, of his career, you know, that now is going to mean that they have a 2 year delay in what looks like a needed rebuilding process.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of good intention there, but that dynamic is definitely in play.
All right, so let me let you go here. Where can we catch up with you on Twitter, and tell us what you've been writing lately?
Yeah, you can find me at Rob Mahoney on Twitter. You can find my work and all my colleagues' work at si.com/NBA. I spent training camp with the Pelicans, so you can see, you know, my feature on how what their prospects look like under Alvin Gentry and how good Anthony Davis is going to be. We've been rolling out some season previews. You should pick up this week's Sports Illustrated to see some great cover stories from Chris Mannix and Lee Jenkins, and I have a bit in there on why Anthony Davis is going to be the MVP. There's a lot going on, but keep glued to the site, and you should catch the bulk of it.
Yeah, I've been reading that Pelican stuff. That's actually that's excellent. I highly recommend that. As for me, you can follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Keep up with my writing on my Facebook page, also NateDuncanNBA. And if you care to support our little endeavor here with the podcast, you can use the cap space code, all one word, on SeatGeek or DraftKings. And you can also, if you don't want to do that, give us an iTunes rating or ranking. That's something that was really helpful. Or just spread the word via social media, or gasp word of mouth because you actually talk to somebody in person, which I rarely do. I mostly talk to people over Skype on my podcast these days. But all right. Well, thanks, Rob, for coming on. We really appreciate it.
Oh, no, it's been a good time, and I've been enjoying following along. You and your guests have been my running buddies for a while now, so thanks for that.
Well, that's surprising. I think I would be in better shape if I were joining you for that. But, yeah, I got to get in shape for the Sloan pickup games this year. Hopefully you'll make it. I think you weren't there last year, which was kind of too bad. But I always need another big guy to go up against.
There aren't as many big guy basketball writers as you might imagine.
All right, man. Well, thanks a lot. And for Rob, I'm Nate. We will talk to you all next time.